think I'm going to teach you a Hebrew song. Can I teach you a Hebrew song? This is really easy, very simple. You only have to know a couple of words. Shalom is one of them. You know that one, right? Shalom, can you say shalom? Yeah, shalom. You know, down in southern Israel, they say shalom y'all. Just wanted you to know that. That's down in Judah, southern Israel. So another word that you need to know is chavarim. Chavarim, that's friends. Friends, chavarim. Say chavarim. And laitrot. Laitrot, which means see you later, till we see each other again. So here's the song. You can join in with me. It's easy. Okay? By the way, the setting for this song is, this is a song that you serenade to your friends after you have spent an evening hanging out together. Right? So as you give one another a hug and out the door, you know, and you're saying goodbye to one another, you sing this song to one another. Okay, maybe some of you know this song. I don't know. Are you ready for it? I'll sing it. You join in with me. It's easy. Shalom chavarim, shalom chavarim, shalom, shalom. Laitrot, laitrot, shalom, shalom. You sing. Shalom chavarim, shalom chavarim, shalom, shalom. Laitrot, laitrot, shalom. Shalom. In English, it's have peace, my friends, have peace, my friends, have peace, till we meet again, till we meet again, have peace. If I can remember, we'll sing that to one another afterwards as we're serenading one another heading out the back door here. How's that sound? Does that sound very Presbyterian? We'll make it Presbyterian here tonight. Okay, so we are in the midst of a four-week study as we imagine what it's like together to visit some sites in Israel that you've heard of, names that you've heard, and to try to connect some of these sites with some pictures that I've taken over the years, and also connect these sites with a particular passage from Scripture so that you get a kind of a sense of what it might be like, right, for you to actually visit some of these particular sites. There's three that hopefully we have the time to look at today and to imagine what it might be like to visit these sites. One is Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi. And if you remember Matthew 16, Jesus takes his disciples way up in the northern part of the country of Israel in order to ask his disciples a very important question. And that question is, who do people say that I am? The setting for that is Matthew 16 at Caesarea Philippi. We're going to look at that site. A second site is the site of Shechem. That's the Old Testament name, Shechem. The New Testament name for this same city is Sychar, S-Y-C-H-A-R, Sychar. And this is the location where Jesus met with the Samaritan woman at the well. In the village of Sychar, the Old Testament village of Shechem, which goes way back in Old Testament history to the patriarchs. We're going to look at that site together. And then lastly, Mount Moriah, the village of Nain. The village of Nain, which is at the base of Mount Moriah. The village of Nain, you might recall, is where Jesus raised a young man from the dead, right? The widow's son at Nain. For the next couple of weeks, we're going to look at other sites together, the Pool of Bethesda and the Pool of Siloam in Jerusalem. That's next week. And then our final time together, we'll spend some time exploring the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem and some of the other sites in and around that church that have significance for Holy Week. So let's look first of all at Caesarea Philippi. Do you like maps? I love maps. I think GPSs are of the devil. I one time followed the GPS faithfully and I ended up in a cornfield. So I tend to try, drives my wife nuts. I tend to not follow the GPS. I always want to have my faithful Walmart Atlas, right, that I have underneath my pickup truck seat that I always pull out and follow. So I like maps, maybe you do too. Here's a map of what Israel looked like during the time of Jesus. During the time of Jesus, and it's color-coded for the first century. It's color-coded because it's coded to the different kings that reigned and ruled over this period in the first century. You might remember the name Herod the Great. Not a very good guy, Herod the Great, but when Herod the Great died, his kingdom was divided up amongst his three sons. And so the color coding that you see here in the map pertains to those three sons. And so this region here, the region of Samaria and Judea, is given over to his son Archelaus. Archelaus was not a good guy either, and quite incompetent, so incompetent that the Romans, after just a couple of years, removed him from his reign and decided to rule over Judea directly by means of a governor from Rome, including a guy named Pontius Pilate. So Pontius Pilate is the governor of Judea in the first century because one of Herod the Great's sons was so incompetent, Archelaus.
Is the one that decided to kill Jesus.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. So this is the area given initially over to Archelaus. Then we have two purple sections given over to another one of Herod the Great's sons. This is Herod Antipas. Herod Antipas, he shows up, that name does, in the Gospels as well as in the book of Acts. Herod Antipas has these two purple areas. This yellow area, don't worry about. This is a pagan area called the Decapolis, which means the 10 cities. And so in the Decapolis, we have 10 Greek-speaking, primarily pagan cities that weren't really a part of Israel proper during this time of history. But then we have this large orange space right here. This was given over to a third son of Herod the Great, a fellow by the name of Herod Philip. Herod Philip. And so Herod Philip, when he inherited this land, decided to build his capital city way up here in the north. See the circle that I have there, and if you can read this, it's not very clear in the black print. Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi, named, of course, for Caesar, but also for Herod Philip. This is Herod Philip's capital city that he had built when he inherited this as his land. It became his capital city of the region that he reigned and ruled over. Jesus takes his disciples here, which is about as far north as you can get without moving outside of Israel proper, way up in the north. Now, I should know that Jesus primarily ministered in and around the Sea of Galilee. As you read the gospel stories, many of the gospel stories happen either in Jerusalem, when Jesus goes down to Jerusalem, or up in and around the Sea of Galilee. Jesus' city of operation is a village by the name of Capernaum that served as his kind of home base of ministry. Jesus takes his disciples from Capernaum and they travel all the way up the Jordan River Valley up to the north to Caesarea Philippi, which is really a strange place for Jesus to take his disciples. Quite strange. What can we say about Caesarea Philippi that's strange? Well, first of all, you need to know that Caesarea Philippi is built next to an ancient, very large pagan worship complex dedicated to the Greek god Pan. Now, if you're of my age, I don't know how many of you are my age, but I remember growing up watching a cartoon with Hercules and Pan, right? And he had this sidekick, right? A Greek mythological figure who was half goat and half man, right? and Pan is the Greek god of troublemaking, the Greek god of the woods and the forest, but also the Greek god of mischief. We get the word pandemonium, right? Built off of that word. And so, a strange place for Herod Philip to build his capital city, but he chooses to build it such that the main city gate to Caesarea Philippi opens up into this monumental pagan shrine dedicated to the Greek god Pan. To make it even more interesting, Herod Philip's father had built a temple to Jupiter as part of that complex, dedicated it to his patron, Augustus Caesar. Now, this whole pagan complex, this pagan worship complex dedicated to the Greek god Pan, had been around for 300 years or so by the time Jesus takes his disciples there. So this is a well-established pagan worship complex where unbelievers went on pilgrimages all the time to this location to offer sacrifices. Now this location, both Caesarea Philippi, the city, as well as the pagan shrine at its entrance, has been thoroughly excavated. Lots of work has been done archaeologically at this site. And when this is one of the sites that we always visit, the site of Panius and Caesarea Philippi. And you can walk around the ruins. You can see some of the archaeological work that has been done there. So this is an artist's rendition of what Caesarea Philippi and Panius would have looked like in its heyday at the time of Jesus. So here we see the city of Caesarea Philippi, main city gate here that opens up into this monumental shrine space that's built into the side of this mountain, and you can see even the sheer limestone cliff right here with a number of buildings that are kind of butted up against that cliff. Here's a close-up, again, artistic rendering based on the archaeology of what this pagan shrine to the Greek god Pan looked like at the time of Jesus. You walk out the main city gate, Caesarea Philippi, and you're right there, front door of this pagan shrine. Here we see, I mentioned the temple that was built and dedicated to Jupiter by Herod the Great. It makes you wonder why people didn't like Herod the Great. Right? He's building temples to Roman and Greek gods. Here's the temple that's dedicated to the Greek god Pan. And off to the side is another shrine. Archaeologists have excavated this space right back here, and it looks like little animal stalls. And so archaeologists believe that these were stalls used to contain goats that were offered as sacrifice to the Greek god Pan at this location. This is what the site looks like today, artistic rendering. And you can see a lot of the archaeological work that's been done here, several acres worth of excavation done here, the city gate entrance right here that leads into what remains of the archaeological site of the Pan worship complex there. And what is this? This is a parking lot where you pull your van in or your bus in and park, and then you go and you search. Are you getting the sense of just how strange this site is? Right, this is not a traditional, faithful Jewish site. This is a quasi-Jewish site, because after all, you're dealing with Herod Philip. But it gives you kind of the sense that Herod Philip was not fully devoted to the Lord, and like a lot of Old Testament kings, engaged in syncretistic kinds of worship. He builds his capital city so that the front door enters into this pagan shrine. This is where Jesus takes his disciples. Getting a sense of just how strange this is? So Matthew 16 reads, "Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, 'Who do people say that the Son of Man is?'" This is a familiar passage. You know this passage. Various disciples, well, some say he's John the Baptist, others say he's this prophet or that prophet. And then Peter steps forward, as Peter often does. But this time he gives the right answer, doesn't he? He says, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus responds by saying, "Yes, this is the right answer, but flesh and blood did not give this to you, but my Father who is in heaven gave you the right answer. And so from now on, Simon, I'm going to change your name. Your name is no longer Simon, but your name is now Peter, Petros, which means rock. And on this rock, I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." Right? Now, we're not going to get into the whole debate of what's meant by, you know, Peter there, is Peter the first pope? You know, we're good Presbyterians here. We would answer no. We're not going to enter into that whole conversation right now. I think that the church is built on the good confession of Peter here, but we're not going to get into that whole discussion. But what I do want to focus on are the interesting words of Jesus that I put in red here at the end of that paragraph. At the end of this paragraph, after Jesus changes Simon's name to Peter, Jesus declares, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." Now, what makes this really interesting, that all this is happening at Caesarea Philippi Panius, what makes it fascinating is this. This is a cave that's incorporated into the Panius pagan worship site. In antiquity, as I showed you from a previous scripture, picture, there was a temple to Pan built right in front of this cave, with the back wall being open into the cave. And we know from Eusebius of Caesarea, who wrote one of the first church histories that we have, right? And he wrote ecclesiastical history around 325 AD or so. And he gives an account of various stories and things that happened in the early church. And he talks in his ecclesiastical history about Panius. And he records that the pagans would go to this shrine and they would take an offering and they would slay the offering, they would sacrifice the offering, and they would throw it into the cave, which had a spring of water that came out of it. And this was an offering that was given over, tossed into this cave and dedicated to the Greek god Pan. And guess what the name was of this particular cave? This cave was understood by the pagans to be one of those ancient entrances into the underworld, into Hades. Interesting. This is where Jesus takes his disciples in order to ask, "Who do people say that I am?" "I will build my church," Jesus says, "and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." Here's a larger scope picture of the gates of Hades, located at Panius, with some of the excavation in front of it. We have some of the remnants of little niches built into that limestone wall that I mentioned. In these niches, there were idols to some of the Greek gods. And we know this is the case because there's etchings in Greek. You can actually read the Greek dedication script at the bottom of each of these niches. Here's a close-up, and you can maybe begin to make out some of the inscriptions in Greek down below. As you turn to the right, you have the remnants of part of that shrine, including that building that housed the animal sacrifices, archaeologists believe. Right? So what makes all of this fascinating, it seems to me, is what else the archaeologist found at this site. At some point in history, this entire pagan shrine complex was destroyed. Maybe it was an earthquake, maybe it was human hands, and archaeologists disagree on this particular point. But guess what was built in its place? In the 4th century, some Christians came along, and on the rubble of this pagan shrine dedicated to the Greek god Pan, they built a church. Archaeologists have just been excavating the remains of this church for the last 2 or 3 years, and they know it's a Christian church because the mosaic floor has crosses inscribed in it. And some of the walls, the large ashlar limestone blocks, we see one of them there in the bottom left-hand corner, inscribed with crosses. 4th century A.D. Why do you think they built a church? Why do you think they built a church right here? Do you think they knew Matthew 16? I think they knew Matthew 16. And so these Christians intentionally came along because they knew that this is the location where Jesus said, "Peter, on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. But the power of the gospel will go forth, and the church of Jesus Christ will be built in all kinds of strange and unusual places, even over the remnant of a pagan shrine to a Greek god, Pan." So what can we take from this? What spiritual lesson might we take from this site, the site of Caesarea Philippi? Seems to me that we can at least take this spiritual lesson, that what is Jesus doing when he takes his disciples here? He's taking his disciples to a place that pagans had laid claim to, a geography that they said, this belongs to Pan. And of course, King Jesus isn't satisfied with that. King Jesus is not satisfied with just having nooks and crannies under his kingship, but rather King Jesus, as the words of Psalm 24 says, "The earth is the Lord's." Did you hear that? "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it." So Jesus goes to a place that paganism had laid claim to, and Christ lays claim to that space. Christ desires all the different nooks and crannies of his creation, including geography, but also the nooks and crannies of our lives as well. Amen? So would you like to visit Caesarea Philippi with us sometime? I hope you do. Okay, that's one. One of three. Are we going to get to all three tonight? I don't know. We'll see. Okay, second site that I'd like for us to reflect on is the site of Shechem. The New Testament name for this Old Testament site is Sychar, as I mentioned before. Jesus travels through this area in John chapter 4, and I just want to point out an interesting phrase that John uses as he describes the movement of Jesus. In John chapter 4, verse 1, John writes that Jesus left Judea and departed again for Galilee, and he had to pass through Samaria. Notice I put that in red. Right? Another translation would be, it was necessary for Jesus to pass through Samaria. And some scholars have read this and said, well, you know, that's because the road system wasn't that developed, and maybe there was only one route that Jesus had to take And so that's why it is that it was necessary for Jesus to go in that direction. I don't think that's the case at all. But rather, what we have going on here is the divine imperative. There's a spiritual reason, a willful reason here for the Father to give direction to the Son to go through Samaria intentionally. Because, and I put another map up here, you can see some of the road structures here that lead all over the place. Jesus is down in Judea, probably in Jerusalem, and there's a number of different ways that Jesus could have traveled in order to get up into Galilee. He could have traveled the eastern road that goes down to the Jordan River and then all the way up to the Sea of Galilee. He could have split off west and gone up the Via Maris along the coast. Or he could have done this, which is what he did. He just went due north and traveled up and ultimately making it to Sychar in the north. So it's not that Jesus was limited in the routes that he had to take. There's something going on here where the Father wills that Jesus must go through Samaria and into Sychar. The divine imperative given to Jesus by the Father. So we might ask, why was it necessary for Jesus to take this route? Why? Sychar, very prominent in the history of the Old Testament. Right? The memory of the patriarchs being in and around Shechem is just profound, right? From Genesis chapter 12, when Abraham is initially called by God and he goes into the land of the promise, guess where Abraham pauses for a moment? And the Lord gives him the promise that this will be your land and it is a promise unto your descendants. Guess where Abraham is? Shechem. His grandson Jacob makes his way back to Shechem, buys property there, dwells there most of his life, Jacob does. And according to some of the older sources, not found in the Old Testament, and some of the older sources, Jacob digs a well there, which makes sense because if you're in the part of the world where there's not much water and you buy land, what do you need? And what does Jacob do for a living? He has sheep and goats. So he needs a water source. He digs a well. Fast forward, Moses. Moses, as he's about ready, right, as the Israelites are about ready to cross over the Jordan River and come into the land and engage in the conquest, you know that Moses is not permitted to come across the river and to come into the land because of his sin, because of his failure. Moses ends up being buried on Mount Nebo there across the river. That's right, he's not permitted to go across the Jordan River. So Moses commands Joshua, his understudy, that when Israel gets into the land, because Moses can't go in there, when Israel gets into the land, they are to go to, guess where? Shechem. And they are to raise a stone monument that they are to cover with plaster, and they're to write the Ten Commandments on that plaster stone as a memorial to God's faithfulness and Israel's need to remain faithful to the covenant. Where does all this happen? Shechem. And so Joshua takes Israel across the river. They engage in the conquest, as you know, and then Israel goes to Shechem. And twice, this episode happens twice, one at the beginning of Joshua's ministry and one at the end of Joshua's ministry. He has half of Israel on one side of the mountain at Shechem, and on the other side of the mountain at Shechem, the other half of Israel, and they yell back and forth. They yell back and forth the blessings and the curses of the covenant. You remember that story? Where does that happen? It happens here at Shechem. So what am I doing here? I'm recounting all of these significant, right, redemptive, historical, covenantal-laden stories of the Bible. Do you think then God just kind of gives up on this location? Says, oh, not important anymore. This is where Jesus goes in order to meet up with a Samaritan woman at the well. And their whole discussion happens at a place called Jacob's Well. They have this whole discussion about water. You remember the story. Jesus says, you know, if you knew who I was, you'd be asking me for living water. Right? And she, I don't understand what you're talking about. But someday Messiah will come and he will explain all these things. He will explain all these things because she at least had, and you know the Samaritans had the Pentateuch. They didn't have the rest of the Old Testament, but they at least had the Pentateuch. So they were aware of all these stories. They're aware of the covenant promises of God, centered and focused in and around where? Shechem. When Messiah comes, he'll explain all these things to us. And there's Messiah right there in front of her. And where does this happen? Shechem. And you realize that she came to know Jesus that day, and she, in all of her sin, went into the town and told everyone. And they all came out to hear Jesus. And Jesus stayed there for 3 days. And many Samaritans, think about that, many Samaritans became Christians during those 3 days that Jesus was where? In this place that's filled with covenant memory. Jesus fulfills the covenant at this location. Now, you want to see some pictures of what this looks like? Okay, here's a large kind of panorama view. Here's Shechem or Sychar, right in the saddle of these two mountains. This is Mount Ebal, and this is Mount Gerizim. I want you to imagine those two covenant ceremonies that Joshua held. Imagine half of Israel at the foot of Mount Ebal, the other half of Israel over here on the foot of Mount Gerizim, yelling back and forth the blessings and curses of the covenant. All of that happening in this location. Here's another picture, a close-up. And you can see how this is possible. You know, I remember reading this text thing, how could they hear each other? You know, if they're one group over here on the top of this mountain, another group over, how could they hear each other if it's really close and compact? I mean, it's certainly within the realm of certainty that you could stand here and yell across the valley over here and hear the other person, let alone these large groups, right? So here is Shechem, the modern city of Shechem, Mount Ebal here, Mount Gerizim here, and some pictures that I took of what remains of the archaeological site of Shechem. The city fortification walls, one of the gates that goes in and out of the city, and then this fascinating artifact. What does that look like to you? Looks like a stone monument, doesn't it? Stone monument, plaster on it, it's broken. So what is this? Well, you know, archaeologists are good for debating. Some conservative archaeologists would say maybe, just maybe, this is the stone monument of Joshua. Maybe. Other archaeologists dispute this. You know, you can see that there's no writing on it, so it'd be hard to verify, but it's in the right place. Approximate time, maybe. I wouldn't go to the rack on it, but it's in the right place and maybe goes back to the right time. There is Mount Gerizim off to the left, And there's Mount Ebal off to the right. That's Shechem. Pretty cool stuff, isn't it? Last place, and I have 2 minutes to do this one. So I'm just going to make a couple of very brief comments here. Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah is a lesser known mountain in Israel. Probably when you think of the mountains in Israel, you think of the Mount of Olives, right? Or maybe you think of the Mount of Transfiguration or Mount Hermon or some of the other mountains. Maybe when you think of mountains in Israel, you don't think of Mount Moriah, right? A lesser known mountain that's actually found in the Jezreel Valley way up in the northwest of Israel, real close to Mount Carmel. It sits in a valley beside another mountain called Mount Tabor. That mountain might be familiar to you if you know the story of Deborah, Mount Tabor. But anyhow, Mount Moriah is important in the Old Testament because at the base of Mount Moriah, there was a village by the name of Shunem. Do you remember the village of Shunem from the Old Testament? The village of Shunem associated with the story of the prophet Elisha. And you remember one of the strange stories, and there's some strange stories associated with Elisha. And one of those stories, you know, has to do with not making fun of bald men, right? So I always like to point that one out, right? That's a strange story associated with Elisha. So let that be a warning to you children, right? But another strange story that's associated with Elisha is Elisha befriended an older couple that didn't have children. And when he passed through this village of Shunem, he would stay with them. They were hospitable. They invited him to stay, so much so that eventually they built a bedroom on the roof of their house, right? So that every time he would come through town, he would stay with them, and he'd go upstairs on the roof of the house, and he'd stay in the bedroom that they built on the roof of the house. And he became good friends with this older couple. They never had children, though. And so as they became good friends, as good friends tend to do, Elisha asked them, "How can I pray for you? How can I inquire of the Lord for you?" And so the woman said, "Would you pray for us that we might have a son?" And so as the story goes, about a year from that point, they had a child, they had a son. And the son grew up and apparently apprenticed with his father to be a farmer. And the story goes on that this young man was out working in the fields with his father. And the text tells us that he got this tremendous headache, and the young man fell over dead. You remember this story? And they carried the corpse of this young man up to the bedroom on the roof of the house and laid his body out on the bed of Elisha, in the same room where Elisha would stay when he would come visiting. And then the woman sent a servant out to track down Elisha. They found Elisha, brought him back to the house, and this is where the story gets really weird. Elisha goes up to the upper bedroom, and he lays down on the corpse, mouth to mouth, foot to foot, hand to hand, lays down on the body of this corpse and begins praying. Prays for a while, then he gets back up and he walks around the bed. And he does the same thing again. He lays down on the corpse, mouth to mouth, foot to foot, wrist to wrist. I mean, it's not normally the kind of thing that you do whenever something like this happens, right? It's really a strange passage, you know. And then after a time, all of a sudden, the boy comes back to life. Now we know that there's no coincidental stories in the Bible. The Bible is true and inspired and inerrant in all of its detail. So you read a story like that and you wonder, what in the world is going on here? Prophet Elisha lays down on a corpse and, you know, that's I guess that's not quite as weird as bears coming down and eating people for making fun of bald guys, right? But it's way up there, isn't it? So this happens where? This resurrection story happens where? It happens in the village of Shunem, which is located at the base of Mount Moriah. Now, Elisha is an 8th century prophet, 8th century BC. Fast forward about 800 years, and you come to the time of Jesus. And we have Jesus traveling from Galilee all the way over to Nain. And it seems like he does this, right, just out of the blue. He leaves the general location of where he engaged in ministry in and around the Sea of Galilee. He leaves that area and he heads over to Nain. Where is Nain located? Nain is located about a mile and a half from Shunem. Nain is also at the foot of Mount Moriah. So out of the blue, Jesus goes there. And as Jesus and his disciples come to the village of Nain, there's a funeral procession. A widow has lost her only son. And they're bringing this only son out on a funeral bier, right? Taking him out outside the city to bury him. Jesus walks up, the text tells us, and he places his hand on the funeral bier, and this young man comes to life. And again, where does this happen? Nain, which is at the foot of what mountain? Mount Moriah, just a mile and a half or so away from what village? Shunem. Same general location and almost the same exact storyline. The only son of a widow raised from the dead. Do you think the people at Nain recognized what was going on here? People that grew up and lived at the foot of Mount Moriah knew the stories of Elisha. They'd grown up with them. And so when Jesus raises this young man to the life from the dead, notice what the crowd says. And I put it in red. See what the crowd says? The crowd says, quote, "A great prophet has arisen among us. God has visited his people." Do you see how they address him as what? Great prophet. In other words, one like Elisha has come. But is this one like Elisha only? If you know the story, did Jesus have to do all this weird stuff to raise this young man from the dead, like lay on his corpse and mouth to mouth, foot to foot, wrist? No. Jesus does what? Speaks a word. He speaks a word, and this young man bursts forth with life. And where does this happen? Mount Moriah, same place where Elisha engaged in his miraculous work, the work that the Lord gave him. Here are a couple of pictures of this area. This is a picture that I took from Nazareth, actually. I'm standing on the Nazareth Ridge. Behind me in this picture is Nazareth. And in front of me, you'll see two mountains. This is Mount Tabor. You can't miss it. Right? Looks like a volcano. This is associated with the story of Deborah. But off to its right, you see another mountain right here that sprouts up right in the middle of the Jezreel Valley. And this is Mount Moriah right here. The reason I show you this picture from this perspective is as I'm taking this picture looking this way, behind me is Nazareth. So I want you to realize that this is the perspective that Jesus would have had growing up, looking out across the Jezreel Valley, seeing Mount Tabor. And do you think he knew the Old Testament stories associated with Mount Tabor? Here's Mount Moriah. Do you think Jesus knew the stories associated with Mount Moriah? So there's intentionality here on the part of Jesus as he goes and does these things. Here's what Nain looks like today, the modern village of Nain. And then, of course, you have to have a church, right? So here is a church that's built in the village of Nain that commemorates the general location. I'll just say general location because we don't know the exact location, but the general location where Jesus raised the widow's son at Nain from the dead. This church doesn't have much of a pedigree. It's built in the 1880s. So would I go to the rack on this being the exact location? No way. No way. I would not. All right. So what's our takeaway here today? We've seen three different sites that once you have a sense, right, of the geography and what's there, it helps to kind of bring to light just a little bit the story of Jesus that's associated with each of these areas. And with all of that, let's stand and sing. As we say goodbye to one another, and you know the Apostle Paul said, greet one another with a holy kiss. No, you don't have to do that. Don't worry about that. But turn to your friend and sing to them here, okay? Turn to your friend and sing to them, Shalom Chavarim. Are you ready? Shalom Chavarim, Shalom Chavarim, Shalom, Shalom. La'itrot, shalitrot, Shalom, Shalom. Have peace, my friends, have peace, my friends, have peace, have peace. Till we meet again, till we meet again, have peace, shalom, y'all.